But yeah, so we've looked at kind of what the early church looked like, how they struggled with the underground movement, all these things. And then up to last week in 300 AD, when Constantine became the emperor and converted to Christianity, and Christianity became the state religion. We saw it taking root in politics and becoming the official religion of the empire. So now they had the government's favor. It was popular and cool to be a Christian and all the, what that meant for them. How some people wrestled with the purity of it. Is this still a good Christianity now that we're not being killed and persecuted for our faith? And some of the extremes they went to, we looked at monasticism and the Donatists who tried to break away and separate. But along with some of those social and political things, we also looked at some theological things. We looked at two big councils last week, the Council of Nicaea and Chalcedon. I didn't really get to this because if we're just going quick, there were tons of councils, tons of them. We could do a whole class just on councils. I just hit the two biggest ones. Generally speaking, Nicaea and Chalcedon were the two biggest ones. They looked at, ultimately, the nature of Jesus. First one being fully God, the second one is full of humanity. And then Chalcedon also the Holy Spirit. So kind of notice now for 2 weeks, what I tried to do with this class is sort of paralleling political, real-world events, things that are happening with theological things at the same time. And we started the class, we talked about why study church history. And one of them was to know what happened, learn from it, but also to know why we believe what we believe. And so I'm kind of doing both of those things at the same time. As I've also mentioned, and you feel a little more tense tonight, it's hard to tell the story of history because the story of history is linear. This happened, then this happened, then this happened. But trying to infuse theology in it, it's like, well, this happened here, but they decided this here, and it kind of took 400 years for this. So it kind of feels like we're bouncing around a little bit. There's no way to talk about church history without doing some bouncing around. It doesn't just go straight. So this course with you guys, I've tried to really take a big step back and be as much kind of flowing towards the future as I can, rather than, you know, getting into all the weeds. That's going to be the same tonight, even more so maybe. Tonight, you're going to hear a lot of, I guess, more historical story. A lot of the things that we're going to talk about, there's not quite as much theology. There's some are, you're going to hear more names. And I've tried to avoid bogging you down with names and dates and things like that, because they just blur together. You don't remember them all. I certainly don't. But there are some names that are good to know. If you look at your notes, I was just making a joke about it, you're going to have some blanks on your notes. And your mind is going to tell you, well, Pete left that blank, so that must be the most important word. That's not true. I was just trying to give you something to write in. Sometimes I'll want you to write the important word. Other times it's just trying to keep you awake. So don't think like, well, this must be the most important word. Some of them, but for the most part, I'm just trying to, I find that when I have something to fill in, my brain stays connected after an hour, hour and a half. So again, the notes are just for over easy form. So we're going to take a slightly bigger lurch towards the future, about 800 years tonight. And we're going to start similarly to where we started in the first class 2 weeks ago, which was this big, massive, cataclysmic event, if you remember, when Jerusalem, the capital city, fell to the Romans. And that sort of started this whole thing where the church split off and Christianity began. Tonight, we're going to start with something similar, a massive, much bigger cataclysmic event. We're going to talk first about the fall of Rome. Now, I want to give you a little thing here. I'm going to say the word Rome a lot. And sometimes when I say Rome, I'm referring to the Roman Empire, which was a massive, huge spread across the Mediterranean Sea. Other times, I'm literally going to be talking about the city of Rome, and I'll try to clarify. When I say the fall of Rome to start, though, this 410 to 475, I'm talking about the whole thing. We're talking about the big, massive thing. For about 600 years, roughly there, so around 200 BC, 200 years before Jesus, Rome grew to power, both through a very strong central government and a brilliant change in military tactics, the Roman phalanx. We're not going to get into that. Rome dominated the world. No one could stop them. They never lost a war. They had a few stalemates, but nobody could compete with Rome for about 600 years. By the time of Jesus, they were 200 years in at their peak and their power, and that lasted for another 200 or 300 years or so. By the mid-300s, things started to go downhill a little bit. We'd become Christian. There had been a lot of internal strifes. The empire got so big, it became hard to fully manage. We talked about how they tried to break up and have multiple rulers. Eventually, they decided to have like sort of two emperors co-ruling. That was always creating tension in the East and the West. And in the late 300s, a group of Germanic horde, you always call them hordes when they're the enemy, they're just people, Rome called them a horde, decided to take a shot and attack the city of Rome and succeeded. And that opened the way for all the other people living in what is currently Germany, France, that sort of northern, middle northern Europe, were like smelling blood. They smelled weakness. And it started officially in about 410 or so. And basically what you need to know is for 600 years, Rome was the bully. Rome was the power. And when you're the power, you do what you want. You treat people however you want. You say what you want. You take what you want. And they did for 600 years. And some of the people they treated the worst, they called barbarians. You've heard the word barbarian. The word barbarian from a Latin literally is bar, 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 bar. It's a racial epithet. It's you're making fun of people because the Romans in their cultured Latin would hear someone from Thessalonica or modern day Germany talking in their own language. Oh, listen to those bah, bah, bah. They can't even talk right. You know, they're making fun of them being uncultured. So anybody that wasn't part of the Roman Empire and spoke Latin and was just, you're just backwater hicks, especially these people north of Italy. What did they, like Germany, especially the Germanic tribes, the French, and then the Brits. These were all barbarians, uncultured people. And for the most part, Rome did whatever they wanted, took them as slaves. They didn't treat them very well. At this point, these groups of people started realizing that now was their chance. And so they saw it as an opportunity to, some of them wanted to become Romans. They wanted to join the empire. Others of them just held resentment for the conquests and war and 600 years of abuse. And others just saw an opportunity to get rich. Like if Rome's weak, there's a lot of money in Rome. So the first one we see was a guy named Alaric. Again, you don't know these names, but Alaric was part of a group called the Visigoths. And the Visigoths in 410, does that work maybe? Let's see. Nope, wrong way. I had it upside down. The Visigoths invaded for the first time the city of Rome in 410 and pulled it off. They sacked the city. They took whatever they wanted. They basically realized in 410 that they were stronger than the Roman legionaries. First time in 600 years someone had done that. They didn't stay. They just made a mess. They vandalized. They stole a bunch of stuff, and they left. But when they left, all these other tribes they lived around, the other Vandals, the Goths, the Visigoths, the Lombards, they were all like, did you hear that Rome is really weak? So for the next 60 years, on and off, you would have these Germanic hordes, these people from the north, these barbarians, would just swing down and destroy stuff and steal stuff. And people living in once powerful Roman Empire are now living a much different reality. They're living in fear. They're living in chaos. They don't know when some random guys in, deer skin are going to come and kill them. It is a whole crazy time. But then in 475, the Vandals come. And the Vandals don't just want to, ironically, because we use the word Vandal differently nowadays, the Vandals didn't want to be Vandals. The Visigoths were Vandals. The Vandals wanted to actually conquer. And they said, let's actually just take over and make ourselves in charge of Rome. So the Vandals came in and essentially deposed the Roman emperor. And this was officially in 475, the end of this thing we call the Roman Empire. It was kind of kaput at that point. Now, this was something that had stood for 600 years, right? Half a millennia that now crumbles. And what's the thing I want you to understand is when we talk about the fall of the Roman Empire, again, it really was a fall from one perspective, because at this point, by the end of the 5th century, this is the whole Roman Empire at the peak of its power. And they really kind of controlled this stuff up here. They just didn't really care about it. So somewhere around the middle, about 320 or so, this is Rome. The Emperor Constantine moved his capital way over here to Constantinople in modern-day Turkey. And that became the center of the empire. But Rome still kind of was Rome. So what happened was the empire kind of started to splinter. And you had the east side of it, modern-day Asia, Asia Minor, Greece, all the area. And then the west side sort of became a little bit separate. And the eastern side in Constantinople actually had their own emperor who survived when the city of Rome fell. So when Rome here, when this all collapses, the east kind of maintains a little bit. But all of this just falls apart. So where you were would have mattered. for years leading up to the emperor's fall, this was already starting to create a rift between East and West, and this would just make it worse. So while the Western half crumbled, the East kind of held together, some semblance of order, a central government. If you lived in the Eastern part of the empire in the 400s, the 500s, it wasn't nearly as crazy. If you lived in Italy, Spain, France, life was very weird at this point. So it was the beginning of a divide between, and this divide would only continue to grow, where you had once this united Catholic, which means everything, the one universal church, you now start to see it splintering into an Eastern and a Western, both as a church and as a people. The empire is now sort of breaking apart and cutting in half. Today, the Eastern Orthodox Church has probably a bit alien to most of us. If you know any Eastern Orthodox, you'd be like, what is this? It really went kind of a different direction. The Western Church turned into Catholicism. We're going to talk about that. And eventually, Protestantism, where we are today, for a lot of us. But we're going to talk about some of the overlap. A lot of that will be in our next class. So in July, I'm going to talk a lot about how those two splinters eventually turned into the Reformation and Methodism and Nazarenes and Baptists and how we all sort of came from all these different places. That'll be part two. But most of us are much more familiar with what we would call Western Christianity, what happened over here, because what happened over here, their great-grandchildren eventually settled America, right? The people that were over here in the East are kind of foreign to us because we don't have a lot of connection to them unless maybe you come from a different root system. So we're going to talk a lot about Western Christianity. And when I say Western Christianity, I'm meaning what happened here kind of after they started to pull apart. That make sense? Okay, so you're going to hear me say that a lot. Rome, Western Christianity, Eastern, that's what I'm talking about, that divide. One of the reasons why, I want to talk about some people. One of the goals of church history, as I talked about in week one, was understanding what we believe and why we believe it. And when we start to look at the divide of these two massive parts of the empire and Christianity, we don't just see a divide of culture or traditions, we actually see a divide of theology. The people that live sort of on this side start to think a little bit differently than the people on this side. And those of us that sort of have roots on this side, we think a certain way from maybe people in 2022 that have different roots. One of those main roots is rooted in a very, very important popular person that you've probably heard before. I know you've heard the name before. A man named Augustine or Augustine, the same way of saying the name. Augustine of Hippo, if you ever hear Augustine or Augustine, same word. St. Augustine was one of the most pivotal voices of theology. In fact, a lot of people would argue he's probably the most prominent, important theologian in the history of the church. Augustine lived in the middle of the 300s, and he died in 430. And I'm only giving that date because, if you remember, that basically means that his whole adult life, he was living in a time where all these groups were coming and attacking Rome, right? And for him, he was an Italian, he lived near Rome. So his whole adult life, his whole time as a non-Christian, a Christian theologian, was during the time that Rome was collapsing. And he actually died just a few, maybe a couple decades before it fully fell apart. But we know a lot about Augustine. I'm not going to get into it because we just have time. Great story. The reason we know so much about him is because he was one of the first theologians to actually write a biography. So you can read a book he wrote called Confessions, which is just his whole life story. It's actually really good. But we know that essentially he grew up in a rich family, very intelligent, and he was super, super educated. And he tried a lot of different philosophies. He was into Platonism, all this different stuff. And eventually, through a couple of cool experiences, he became a Christian. And when he became a Christian, because he had so much learning and experience and so much in-depth understanding of philosophy, he was sort of already set up to be like a really deep, profound thinker. And he had a ton of influence before he became a Christian. So he was already sort of set up to be like the guy, right? And he did. He wrote a ton of stuff. He became very prominent. And he established a lot of what the Western church would go on to believe. Many people would say he's the father of Western Christianity. And so some of the things that he taught and talked about are things that, you know, today you're almost like, well, yeah, of course. You wouldn't even know. It's like it started with him. I want to give you a couple examples. I'm not going to go super deep here, but just let me give you a few things about Augustine or Augustine. Number one is that a little better? I don't know. Is that pretty bad? Keeps making noises. I'm sorry. Yeah, maybe this is too loud, I don't know. Augustine really was the first person to use the phrase original sin. And I know you're like, okay, are we getting deep here? Let me just briefly talk about this. Augustine was basically saying, contrary to other philosophies, the world isn't bad because God made a mistake. It's bad because we are the problem, right? So Augustine was like, very much like, we're the problem. Human free will has brought about brokenness and sin. Therefore, human decision can bring about change. But he also sort of moved into this idea that original sin is what needs to be dealt with. Now, how deep do I go here? For Augustine and other people in the West, and I'll talk about this a bit more, the people in the West, Augustine followed a guy named Tertullian. If you've heard that name before, probably not. But Tertullian lived a few centuries before him. Tertullian was a lawyer. And what you'll see is people in the West tended to approach Christianity very legally. And I don't mean legalistic, but I mean in the sense of like guilt, courtroom, judge. And so for Augustine, his idea was we're sort of born guilty and we need to find a way to deal with this guilt we're born with, this sin we're born with, and that only happens in Christ. For a lot of Protestants who live in America today, that's like, well, yeah, of course. Isn't that what everybody believes? Well, actually, the Eastern people didn't so much. That was very Augustine, that God is a judge and we are guilty before the judge. And one day we're going to stand before him and he's going to say guilty or not guilty. That sort of starts with Augustine really clarifying it and putting it into words. On top of that, he argued a lot with you can't do it yourself. Augustine was one of the first people that said, this guilt that I have, this original sin that I have, I can't do anything about it. Only God. Like, I can't work for it. I can't earn it. You might remember last week, you probably don't, it's okay. I talked about how the monks often had this view in their minds that they had to go in the desert and like beat themselves to make God love them, to earn God's favor. That was a very common belief. And again, most of you, if you have roots here in Western Reform Christianity, like what we live in today, it's very common for us to say, we don't earn grace. Well, Augustine was one of the first people to really argue for that. Most Christians in the fourth century weren't saying you don't earn grace. They're like, you gotta earn, you gotta work for it. Augustine's like, no, you don't. He argued with a guy named Pelagius who was like, you need to work on things. And Augustine's like, no, it's faith alone. So years later, when the Reformation would happen, they would look back to Augustine and say, faith alone, right? Dealing with original sin. And that would still be the case. He stressed the sacraments for salvation. Now, at the risk of making your eyes cross, I need to explain this because this maybe one of the most important things I say to set up the next hour. A sacramentum is something that is holy. It's a ceremony, whatever. Starting with Augustine in his time period, they sort of, I don't know how to say this. I don't want to overstate it, so give me some grace here. It was almost like the church was doing things that were like traditions. And starting with Augustine, they went from traditions to like actual like spiritual realities. So this thing we talked about, like the Lord's Supper, when they would just get together and share a meal and talk together and remember what God did, went from just a meal connecting to taking this bread and this juice is receiving the grace of God. And if I don't do this on a regular basis, I'm not a Christian. Baptism went from this sort of public profession, a pledge of allegiance to, no, baptism actually is what deals with your original sin. That's not in the Bible. That was Augustine. And churches, Christians have wrestled with that now for 1,500 years. Does baptism actually do anything real or is it just a ceremony? Augustine's like, no, these things are real things. And we have to be doing them. Augustine never actually said, you're not a Christian if you don't do these things. He never went that far. But the people that followed him definitely would. So just to plant a little bug in your brain, if you can only be saved through the sacraments, how do you get the sacraments? How do you get baptized? How do you receive communion? Who marries you? Who's responsible for giving you these sacraments? The church. So he started something that would have lasting impact. Another big thing about Augustine I want to share is he was living in a time where things were crazy and constant threat. He devised something called the just war theory. And you've maybe never heard of the just war theory, but you live in America, You know the just war theory. Essentially, he said for 300 years, Christians were saying, we're pacifists. Put your swords down. Christians don't engage in violence. Augustine was the first one to say, well, actually, if the Vandals are going to come and burn your house down, you can fight back. If something is justified, you can fight. Okay, Augustine, well, what justifies war? Well, you know, there's a lot to it. We got to think through it. But really, you know, you should trust church leadership to decide. Okay, Augustine, how's that going to work out for you 1,000 years later? We'll see. So the Western church believed original sin. You're guilty before God. You can't do anything about it. Eventually, I need the church to give me the sacraments to deal with my sin. And the church has the authority to tell us when to fight, when not to fight. He's, maybe not intentionally, but he's establishing some of my things that would really take root and change the way the church worked. Okay, that was some quick stuff. I'll bring up Augustine again over the next hour for sure. A lot more I could say, but this would touch on these ideas, influence the direction of the church. Now in the East, they didn't necessarily think all this stuff. There was less chaos, a stronger government. They weren't worried about just war theory and stuff like that quite as much. But they would have their own theologies that would work themselves out. Okay, so we're in this moment where you've had a strong, powerful government, strong, powerful military. They did whatever they wanted to. You lived in complete peace and harmony, and then everything is crumbling, right? It's all falling in disarray. Once the government goes away, you now have all these people groups who are subjects of the government. Some of them by force, some of them are forced in. Well, if the government's going away, I'm out of here, right? So it, like the Goths, who were basically subjects of Rome, subjects, we're gonna kill you. Once Rome collapses, they're like, forget you guys, we're doing our own thing. The entire Western Europe, what today is Italy, Spain, all that area, broke apart into feuding little city-states, where every little area, like Milan, would have its own mini king who ran their city, and he would war against others, and everyone was all for themselves. It was chaos. And so in this moment where everything's falling apart, what usually happens is the little people are the ones that suffer, right? Because yes, sometimes the government can be unfair and trample, but really for the most part, having a good, strong government is good for the people that can't defend themselves. And this became known as what we call the Dark Ages. The medieval period is the nicer way to say it. But it was a period of time where government had fallen apart. Things are just chaos. No one's in charge. People are abusing each other. And through this darkness and chaos, with no strong government, how would we move forward? One group sort of rose up and answered the challenge. Pastoral leaders that would eventually be known as popes. And this is the rise of the papacy begins to happen at this point. Starting shortly after Augustine's death, he probably would have been a pope himself. But the title pope, you've heard it before, it comes back to papas, which just means father. They had been using that to speak of religious leaders for a while. But at some point fairly early on, that specific term, rather than just being anybody that was sort of a religious leader, really began to focus on the Bishop of Rome, who was considered the highest member of the church, because they argued that's, you know, where Peter was the head of the church, in Rome. This started pretty early on in the first century. Clement, in the really early 200s, wrote a letter talking about how the Bishop of Rome alone had power to decide who was a presbyter, all this stuff. The Bishop of Rome would often be called upon to settle disputes and call councils, answer theological questions. And even with Constantinople becoming the capital, Rome still had a lot of power because most people still saw Rome as sort of the top dog in terms of the church. And so the Bishop of Rome always held prominence. But when Rome collapsed, when the city fell apart, it left the government too weak to care for people. We see stories of essentially like these political leaders who, again, nobody called political leaders servants in the ancient world. That's a very later thing. You weren't a servant of people. You were in it for money and power. And so when everything fell apart, most of the guys that were in government ran for the hills, literally, packed up their stuff and got out. When plagues and famine and wars and like a lot of the guys that were supposed to be holding things together just took off and ran. And so in that void, you needed someone to step up. And religious leaders started doing it. A couple names, again, you don't need to know these, but here they are. The first one was a guy named Leo the First. He became Leo the First because there were more Leos later. Eventually called Leo the Great. Have you ever heard of the name Attila the Hun? Maybe you heard of Attila the Hun? Attila the Hun came down and basically wanted to conquer Rome again and just take whatever he wanted. The people were scared. No one in the current pseudo-government would do anything about it. They were all hiding from Attila, this great warrior. So the bishop of Rome, a guy named Leo, literally went outside the city gates to talk to Attila himself. The person, again, just to himself. And Attila was brutal. He was a killer, destroying everything in his path. And he was about to sack Rome. And they called him the Scourge of God because he loved killing Christians. We don't know what they talked about. It's lost to history. But he actually somehow managed to convince Attila to leave. And again, we have no idea what he said. But it's pretty impressive. Attila didn't attack the city, didn't steal anything, just left. And then a few years later, the Vandals came to sack Rome again, and he convinced them to leave. So the whole time that Leo the First is the Bishop of Rome, the city's actually safe. Well, imagine how people would have responded to that. You should be in charge, right? Well, I'm just the leader of the church. So you're in charge. So Leo the First actually became the first pope. They basically declared, okay, you lead us. Gave him tremendous influence. And he actually went on to write a whole treatise based on Matthew 16 about how, well, Peter has the keys of the kingdom. Peter was the first bishop of Rome. So the bishop of Rome is the pope. And that was sort of that. His successor took it even further and argued that the pope should be greater than any earthly ruler because God's kingdom is greater. This is sort of the seeds that we'll see in the future. Succeeding popes would kind of follow in line. They would sort of stand in this gap of being sort of leaders. Some of them were good, some not. Sometimes they would raise money to pay off invaders that were coming into sack Rome. Did what they could. By maybe the 500s, the city, though, is just in ruins. All the great architectural feats have been torn down. Most of the cool stuff from Rome today is just ruins because of this period of time. There's no stable military, no government at this point. It's all gone. We see famine and disease are rampant. The Roman Empire actually did a pretty good job of that stuff. They like forced people to hygiene. And said, well, this is all gone. It's just a mess now. And you have a new threat known as the Lombards who are here. And this is a guy named Gregory, also called the Great. People liked to call you the Great back then if you did great things. Gregory the Great in 590, so we're now almost 200 years in. Rome is starving and plague is setting in the city and everyone is running out of the city to get away. And Gregory, the Bishop of Rome, convinces the Christians to stay. He's like, hey, we're supposed to be here and protect these people. And he went into all the churches that were very elaborately decorated, going back to, you know, the height of the Roman Empire. And he started just selling everything and giving it to care for the people. He like gutted all the church's money and stuff. Which, you know, on the surface, right? Isn't that what they're supposed to do? They made him pope against his will. He's like, I don't want to be in charge. What are you talking about? No. I'm like, come on, Gregory, you're great. Lead us. So Gregory went out and convinced the Lombards not to destroy the city. He started creating systems and trying to rebuild infrastructure, and they made him pope. He, like I said, negotiated peace, and he was one of the first like, so I just give you some context here. Like, imagine if today a foreign army invaded Southern California, and we're like, hey, Brandon, go deal with this, right? Like, Brandon, what are you talking, like, the leader of the church is like organizing, rebuilding the city and putting together a militia to defend. The leader of the church is helping feed the poor with city money. And he's going and talking to invading armies, like, please just leave us alone. Or, you know, the leader of the church, not the governor, not the president. Where is the mayor, right? But this is what it's now come to. Within 200 years of the fall of Rome, everything is falling apart. And it's these Christian leaders who are standing in the gap trying to hold things together. And Gregory was especially known for being just very servant-minded, and he appeared to have a lot of Christian character. There was another church leader in Constantinople at this time who was like wanting to be called the Pope himself. And Gregory said, I don't care, call yourself whatever you want. I'm just a servant. And I mean, people are like, yeah, that's what a pope's supposed to be. Let him lead us. So in some ways, he did a lot. A small anecdote, he was adamantly against slavery and tried to fight against it. But just for clarity, this is not the kind of slavery that you and I think of. In fact, there's a famous story where he's in the slave market and he sees two boys who are just, he thinks they're just, they're like beautiful. They have blonde hair and blue eyes. They're on the slave market. They were Britons, Saxons. And he said, who are these Engels, angels? They're beautiful. And they're like, they're Britons. They're way up north in an island. And he's like, we need to go and evangelize these Engels. And that's actually why today it's called England. English Engels comes from angels. So he actually sent a whole contingent to modern day Europe, Ireland, that whole area, and was the first to evangelize it. So he did some really great things. There were some drawbacks to his leadership. Mainly, he continued this whole thing, even if unwillingly, he was adding to the idea that the leader of the church is more than just a church leader. He's running the show. He was super involved with Augustine's idea that the sacraments are necessary. He believed, he loved Augustine. The sacraments are necessary. If you want to be saved, you've got to be involved in the sacraments. And we have the sacraments. So if you want to be saved, you need us. And this would, again, I think someone like Gregory seems like a pretty good dude, right? You see his life, you see his actions. You're like, yeah, okay. The problem is that once this is established, there's like this office now called Pope. Well, Gregory dies and someone else has to be Pope. Who? And why do they get it? Well, he got it because he was just helping. The next person got it because he was appointed. And then within a few decades and centuries, people aren't getting appointed, they're fighting for it because it's power, right? And I want to stress that the rise of the papacy, like the bringing of it on, it's like someone like Gregory, they gained political power not because they were seeking power. They gained it because they were stepping up when no one else would. You had Christians that were laying their lives down and subjecting themselves to plague and war just to help people. So the foundation is in one really good in one sense. But regardless of why this happened, regardless of why they took power, you know, there's an old saying, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And so you really have to ask the question, was it actually good that these guys started taking the power? No one else was, okay, but they held on to it. They didn't let it go and things got better. And that power eventually became, well, we'll see. Before we get to where that power goes, though, there's another threat that's arising on the scene about the same time, right around the 600s, 700s. Even more than all this instability, as they began slowly putting the pieces back together, the church sort of became the strength in the West to help society come together. Something started happening from outside. A conquering army was making its way to Rome as we saw the rise of this new religion called Islam. Now, Islam, this isn't a world religions class, so we're not going to spend time getting into what Islam is or what it is and things like that. But I do want to understand how they play a role in church history. Starting with, we know in 570, a man named Muhammad received what he said was a revelation. I'm missing an exclamation point there. That he was the last true prophet of God. And he believed in the Hebrew scriptures. He believed Jesus was a great prophet. He just didn't believe in the Trinity. So if you remember from week one, we talked about different people. That actually wasn't that unusual. There were Christians who were arguing with whether Jesus was fully God. But most importantly, here's what Muhammad ultimately believed. Last week, I talked about how when the church lost purity, when it became, what is this? It's like mixing with power and government things. And some people were like, we want a pure form of religion. Muhammad, in his own words, we can see things were down, looked at religious people, looked at Christians, and said to himself, these people are not taking any of this seriously. This can't be true. And when he got his vision from God, from the angel Gabriel, one thing that Gabriel said to him was, God has called you to go out and force people to take this seriously, to submit to God. The word submit is where we get the word Islam, submission, is submit. So the heart of Islam, the heart of the Muslim faith is that God is expecting total obedience. And for the Muslim initial people, that meant pick up your sword. Whatever we got to do, we're going to force you to obey God. If you think about it, the difference between that and what Jesus actually taught isn't that far apart. And if you think about it in terms of the world at the time, he was hardly the only person who was upset with lukewarm Christians who weren't taking their faith seriously. But the direction that he took it would obviously have massive consequences. And his rejection of Jesus as the Christ was a big deal. But because they believed in forcing people to submit, Islam grew very quickly. Now, I want to point out, and I'm not here just to attack other religions, but this is a historical fact. The spread of Christianity in its first three centuries was because people were suffering and dying for it, right? Islam spread because they were really good warriors, and most of the Arabian Peninsula was not very well organized. So a conquering army conquered pretty quickly. Then, after they had conquered all of Arabia, they turned their eyes west towards the eastern part of the empire and beyond, Greece, all that area. And what they found was, again, an empire that was in disarray. So you start here. They quickly conquer all of this. They move into all these areas that were there were no strong governments anywhere in here. And so they just kept conquering and adding more people to their army, getting more and more powerful. And then they start to move up to Constantinople in the Eastern Empire. Then they come this way, all the way up through Spain into France. And by 700 AD, they're already in Western and Eastern Europe, and they control most of the Mediterranean Sea right here, which had always been the Roman Empire. So one reason why they had so much success, again, was how divided the church was. If these two communities of people had been closely tied, there's no way Islam would have spread. But what they found is they attacked here and they attacked here. They didn't help each other. They didn't even talk to each other. They were isolated. And that made for easy targets as they grew further apart. Another thing, and this is important to know too, is that Muslims were actually relatively tolerant, which is interesting because they demanded loyalty to God. But if you were of another religion, they kind of let you go. They kind of let you be. So they didn't force Christians at sword point to become Islam, which we'll see Christians didn't repay that favor. But they kind of let you be. And so, especially here in the East and parts of North Africa, when the Muslims came, it was like, yeah, whatever. a lot of people weren't fighting back because they actually were like, they'll leave us alone. We'll do what we want to do. So it really was fairly easy for Islam to sweep in. And not only was the war itself a threat to the church, and again, I want us to look at the big picture. Once Islam controls all of this, these two groups of people, West and Eastern church Christians, were already struggling and sort of somewhat divided. This pushes them even further apart. For one, they stop, they can't communicate as well because they don't control the Mediterranean Sea. So now for Rome and Constantinople to talk, they've got to do a bunch of travel. It's dangerous. So they really, as soon as, like for the next century or so, when Islam controls a lot of this, they really start to separate and grow apart. Plus, they both blame each other for not helping each other. Constantinople's like, hey, we need help. And Rome's like, we're not coming. And then Rome's like, we need help. And they're not coming. And they both blame each other for the whole thing. So we see more and more unrest between these groups of people. Rather than fighting as unified, they're fighting each other. Now, because there wasn't quite as much chaos in the East, Constantinople actually defends itself. They hold off, and they would hold off for another 400 years. They had a military, they had an emperor, they had their own thing going on. So they kind of held their own. The West, though, was a whole different story. When Islam lands here in Spain, they just go. There's nobody. They conquer this in like 3 years. They get up to France. Nobody's stopping them. And so if you live in Europe, you know, if you're in Rome at this time, you're hearing about the Muslim hordes are invading. They're going to take over everything. We're all going to be converted. These people are freaking out. What are we going to do? So again, what do? Well, they turn to the church. Will the church have a plan? Will the church help us? And so this becomes a new stage in history. Now, I know I'm just giving you a lot of information. What I really want to show, though, with all the information I'm going to give you, it's like I want to show you what happens, but then I want to step back and be like, look at the repercussions of what happened. Because what's about to happen has massive repercussions, okay? So all these people are scared. They're freaked out. What are we going to do? Muslims are coming. The church has an idea. The church says, well, remember all these people that the Roman Empire used to dominate and kill and stuff? They were all like really good soldiers, right? Why don't we ask them for help? So they turn to the Franks, which would be the French people today. About 180 years earlier, Clovis was a leader of the Frankish people. He converted to Christianity. And the reason you need to know that is because most of those Germanic tribes, all that stuff, they were just doing their own thing, Vikings and all these different people. But the Franks actually had some semblance of religion. Now, the way that Clovis converted the Franks was to go into each village with his army and force them to kneel and accept Jesus or have their heads chopped off. We're 300 years now from Constantine and we're killing people to become Christians. But it meant that the Franks were generally favorable to Rome, to the church, right, to Christianity. Okay, that's 500. Fast forward 200 years. And 200 years later, the church goes back to the Franks and says, guys, have you heard about the Muslims coming? Help us. And there's a guy who's currently leading the Frankish people. Again, they don't use the word king. That's not a word yet for them. He's just sort of like their warlord. And his name was Charles Martel. Charles Martel would get the nickname the Hammer because he actually carried a hammer. And he was just a really amazing military genius. Charles Martel got all of his clans together and united all the Frankish people and some of these former Germanic tribes and went and essentially stood against the Muslim invaders in France. And for the first time in 70 years, an army stopped Muslim invasions. They're the only ones that did it. And so he was instantly famous, right? The Hammer, he saved us all. That was the end of the Islamic invasion. They stopped pushing forward. They retreated back into Spain about 7 years later, they left Spain. There's still Muslim influence there, but for the most part, he saved the day. Then they had an idea. The Pope said, man, Charles, thank you for saving us. You're such a great military leader. You know all those other pagans that live around you in Germany and up in Britain? Will you go and force them all to become Christians? Sure thing. He marches his army across Europe, and everywhere he goes, he forces every village he comes to get baptized, or he kills them, murders thousands and thousands of people. For Jesus. Yeah, this is where we've come to. In convincing all the pagans to become Christians, he wins favor. He subjugates the remaining pagans. And at this point, what you now see is, because of the Muslim invasion, Rome turns to a military guy and then basically marries him. Like, you're with us. Go and spread Christianity through war and violence. Pretty soon, Martel and his army have converted most of Europe. And all these pagan groups are now part of the church. They had to be, but okay. So you're now starting to see the first sign of, once again, what's now modern day Europe. Western Europe is now sort of solidifying into sort of a whole. You've got the English, the Germans, the French, Prussians. These different groups are now starting to all come together under the church through violence. In payment for that, the Pope tells Pepin, Charles' son, that he will bless him be made king. So for the first time, you have a king of France. And the important thing here, though, this is a word I put in blue. Why is there a king of France? Because the Pope blessed him. God says, you should be king, Pepin. Why? Well, because your dad did us a favor. You're the king by the will of God, right? So now, it's not just that the king is okay and good with the religion. The Pope is deciding who's king. Think about that. And we're not done. Pepin is the king of the Franks, eventually the French. His son, though, would take it to a whole other level. His son, Charles the Great, or Charles Magne, or Charlemagne, if you've heard that name, would make himself the Holy Roman Emperor of the entire Western Europe. In AD 800, we've now 300 years have passed since Rome fell apart. 300 years. The old Roman Empire is gone. Now a new Roman Emperor is crowned by the Pope. So we've kind of come full circle. And this stood as a major turning point in that it symbolized a full joining, a union, a marriage of church and state, to which the two are now almost inseparable. With Constantine, he made Christianity cool and legal, right? And you could be, it was hip to be. Now it was, this is something completely different. The Pope picked the emperor and made someone the emperor and essentially has revitalized, reestablished the Roman Empire. Interesting that they actually weren't in Rome. That's okay. So at this point, it's been 300 years. And at this point, people talk about the glory of Rome in the old days. They have like, it was so great back then, the glory of the empire and how awesome society was. And we need to make Rome great again and stuff. So in Charlemagne, Charles the Great, there was hope that they could maybe rebuild and fully become what they used to be 300 or 400 years ago. Like, can we get back to the great days of Constantine where we were a dominant power? Only this time we're going to do it the way Augustine told us to do it, which was, we'll be a great power, but the church, God's people, will be in charge. So we'll do it right. That's how it works. No sarcasm. So actually, in truth, Charlemagne turned out to be an incredible leader. Incredible. Some people call this the golden age of Europe in the first millennium. Charlemagne believed in education. He brought about great reforms. He looked at the ancient Rome, their infrastructure, their government, their forms of education. He did a lot of great stuff. He started to form a solid military. He forced all the different tribes to sort of submit to his leadership so he could call on all of them if Islam started invading again. He's starting to form this thing you might think of as an empire in what is modern day Western Europe. Problem though, he died. And his son sucked. Nobody following him was nearly as good as he was. In fact, his grandkids were a train wreck who just wanted power. And we're pretty soon back to the same problems we had before. However, there's now a major change. A major change has happened. It's been slow for you guys. It's been 2 class periods. For them, we're talking about 600 years. There's been this like weird, we're underdogs, we're underground, we're persecuted. Now it's legal, it's cool. Now we're kind of running the show. Now we're in charge, right? By 800 AD, the church was appointing the emperor. And there's now this moment where it's not just the Roman Empire, it's called the Holy Roman Empire. So if you ever hear that phrase, Holy Roman Empire, it's referring to this period of time from 800 to about 1300. So we'll get into that. The Holy Roman Empire is when Europe tries to rebuild the Roman Empire under the Pope, right? Because it's holy. So there's an emperor, but the emperor is submitted to the Pope. And it would be this way for quite a long time. Church and state are now inseparable, a united marriage for a new society that would build the world according to God's kingdom, the way Augustine dreamed. Political and church leaders working hand in hand, I guess. And this would last for about 800 years. Every aspect of Europe in the West would now be connected to the church. And the word that they would use, you may have heard it, was Christendom. You ever heard the phrase Christendom? Christendom was the word they gave to this amalgamation of church and government all blurring together, the two things becoming the same, where the most powerful person is not the emperor, it's the Pope, the leader of the church. The main ideal of Christendom was that everything in life, social, political, personal, all of it, needed to be based on Christian faith. Church law is state law. State leaders are subject to church authority. If you're not subject to church authority, if you don't listen to our authority, we excommunicado, we kick you out. You're removed, right? You can't be part of the church. Now, let me pause and just take a step back. I said this, I know it was about an hour ago, but I'm gonna come back to it. Where does the power behind this come from? Who's the Pope? He's in an army. Is he probably an old guy with a weird head? He can't swing a sword. All that he can do is excommunicado. That's it. That's his only power. But it is the most powerful thing in the world at the time. Why? Because 400 years earlier, St. Augustine first said, you can't be saved without the sacraments. Now, here's the Pope saying, oh, you want to be saved and go to heaven when you die? That's me. Listen to me or you won't. Don't make me kick you out and go to hell. And this is our world. If you rejected their authority, you're excommunicated, which was huge. Again, I'm going to get theological for a second here. I'm sorry, but I need to. This is an overstatement. This is an overstatement, but it's generally true. Until the medieval Middle Age period, when you read Christian writings, and there's a lot of it out there, so it's an overstatement. There's a lot of it out there. But generally speaking, the word hell was not thrown around a lot. Very rarely. It's nowhere like in the first two centuries. Hell was a valley in Jerusalem. When everything starts to hit the fan, especially in Rome, maybe it's a matter of life becomes more precarious. We're all dying of plagues and vandals are killing us. I don't know what it is. But the focus of salvation, when salvation was talked about in the early church, it was almost always referring to resurrection, like the age to come when God would restore the earth and bring us back to life and give us the life we're created for. By this time, salvation is almost completely and utterly spoken of as not going to hell when you die. It was completely afterlife focused. And we even see this in their art. Starting around this time, all the art is like hell and demons and angels fighting each other. Now, I'm not saying that that's not true. I'm just saying, like, historically, that's kind of the thing. If you look at the Eastern Church at this time, it's not their focus. They're not spending a lot of time talking about hell. It's a very Western idea. So excommunication wasn't just like, well, if you don't listen to me, you can't come to church on Sunday. No, no, we're talking about heaven and hell here. We're talking about your eternal destiny. Salvation from hell requires sacraments. If you don't take the sacraments, you're not saved. And if you die, you'll go to hell. The sacraments are God's instrument of grace and can only be given by the church. Ergo, we're in charge or you're going to hell. Okay, good question. In the first century, studies show that literacy is between 3-5%. At this point in history, maybe 0.5% of human beings can read. Nobody has Bibles. All the Bibles are in Latin. Nobody even speaks Latin, they want the Holy Roman Empire. So everything needs to look Roman, which is all in Latin. They don't speak Latin. They speak Italian and French and English. Like, nobody reads the Bible. So who decides and tells you what it says? The people that are in charge. In the valley of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. So the Pope decides, the Pope has ultimate authority to decide. So if the Pope says, this is real, you just say, okay. Right? You don't question the Pope. You don't question the bishops. They decide what's real. Do they have some verses that they can? You just asked me a question that was based on a presupposition. Your presupposition was the Bible is the authority over anything else. They didn't believe that. They believe that starting with Peter and everybody that Peter passed down to, the Pope actually had the ultimate authority. So if the Pope says this is true, you couldn't go to the Bible and say, that's not what the Bible says. Didn't matter, the Pope had authority. There's a really terrible, great movie that mocks this horribly called, Matt Damon's in it and Ben Affleck. dogma. They're angels. They get kicked out of, and they're like, maybe the Pope is about to do something stupid and they want to get in on it because the Pope has authority. It's just mocking the whole thing. It's terrible, but it's pretty funny. But this is what we've come to. Starting with Augustine making this sacraments are important. Now, sacraments are necessary. And if you're not baptized by the church, confirmed by the church, if you don't do penance regularly with a priest, if you don't take the Eucharist, the bread and the wine, if you're not married in the church, and if you're not buried the right way upon death, it's all problematic. A great movie, The Kingdom of Heaven with Orlando Bloom. Fantastic movie. There's this whole scene where his wife commits suicide, and it creates this whole problem because the church says she's going to hell because, you know, they won't do the proper unctions upon death. And it's like, this is the world they lived in. It is power, right? So there's no receiving grace outside the church. There's no deciding what's true outside of the church. The church has the power. So you're lost without the church. And no one in Western Europe is beyond the power of the church. The Pope is all powerful. Christ commissioned the disciples eventually led to the Pope, and here we are. This means it paved the way by the turn of the millennium for just an immense amount of power. The Pope was the emperor, but not of government, of your soul and government. What a world. I don't know. Hey, welcome. So you talk about control, and there's a few ways we talk about this. And I'm going to do these quick. They'll come up in more of my next class. Everything is linked to the church. Education is linked to faith. Must be compatible with church teachings. I'm sorry, what? You're saying that we revolve around the sun? No. Shut your mouth or we cut your head off. Like, this is the world you live in, right? Economics need to be structured to support the church because the church is God's kingdom, right? So I don't care that you're suffering and poor. Pay your tithes to the church or else. Social order, it all imitates patterns that God supposedly set for the church. It's all this big jumble mess called Christendom, church and state combined together. Again, okay, so I guess you have power over my soul, but really, that's all, right? You're not literally going to enforce this. Like, you don't have any, like, physical power, right? You know, well, actually, now that you mention it, we appointed the emperor, so we control the entire army. So anytime that we want to call in the army, we can call in the army. Well, you know, we don't want to call in the army all the time. That's a lot. I got an idea. How about we create our own secret police force to force everyone subversively to do what we want? So they create this thing called the Inquisition, which is essentially that. It was their own Gestapo that worked for the church and would go through society and make sure everybody was doing the right thing. And if not, they would get put on a rack. This was, so they're upholding their own power with their own police force. It's also important to note that during this time, the collapse of Rome, money became mostly worthless. So you had crazy inflation, and eventually, the thing about money, if you stop and think about it, your money has value because the government stands behind it, right? Like, you have a U.S. piece of legal tender. What if the government collapsed and there was no U.S. government? That piece of paper, I mean, it's worthless, right? There's nothing behind it. So there's no money system happening. So if there's no money system, all you have left are goods and services, right? Like, I cook something, I make something, here you go. But ultimately, the real power, the real money is in the land, right? The land is money. The land is power. So something begins to, during the Middle Ages, we develop something called feudalism. Again, this will be a whole class. Feudalism is essentially whereby instead of, you know, a central government, you basically have landowners become the real power and leaders. And people who can't afford a life of their own go and work the land for other people. And you're now a vassal of that land, and you're basically a little higher than a slave. The person that owns the most land is the most powerful. Guess who owned the most land? The church. They amassed tons of property. And all the other landowners had to swear allegiance to the church or they would be excommunicated. I mean, so now the church is controlling the land and the feudal system. And then they found, maybe we can get some ways to make some extra cash. The Pope can do anything he wants. Can he let people out of purgatory? You know, that place that supposedly you go before you earn your way into heaven? Well, he's the Pope, sure. Okay, well, hey, Pope, will you let my grandfather out of purgatory? Yeah, sure. So they developed something called indulgences, where the church begins to make money by selling the Pope's ability to get your grandfather out of purgatory. Now, that's not getting out of hell. If you're in hell, you're in hell, sorry. But purgatory is like a waiting room they made up, which again, the Pope made that one up too. So, church leadership is now a primo job, regardless of what you actually believe. People of terrible character want to buy their way into church leadership or be given high positions in exchange for favors. So another big deal was called investitures. And I know these are big words. I'm just trying to give you a picture here. Essentially, the Pope, you know, the Pope's a different issue. Becoming Pope, you had to have some serious cash to become Pope. Like, if you want to be Pope, you need to, like, get the Medici's involved, one of the powerful families. But, you know, what if you just want to be, like, bishop of a city? You know, I mean, hey, my dad actually, you know, is a huge landowner. And if you make me bishop of this town, you know, investitures were basically selling church positions. So by the turn of the century, the church has its own police force, dominates a lot of the land, is selling spiritual blessings to people, and giving away church positions in exchange for power and favors. In 1075, you had something called the investiture controversy. Do I have a slide for this? I do. You don't need to know this, I'm just telling you. There came a moment where the Holy Roman Emperor, Henry V, who was German, basically was like, I'm the emperor. This is stupid. The Pope can't tell me what to do. I'm going to do what I want to do. So he says, I'm going to employ my own church leaders. Why? Well, because that will tie me to them and they'll be loyal to me and their families are all rich so that I can call on their families when I need arms and money. It's basically like a leader might like marry off their daughter to somebody. By making somebody a bishop or a church leader, you're exchanging favors. So Henry IV is like, yeah, I'm gonna do my own. The Pope says, no, you don't have power to do that. Only I do. Well, what are you going to do about it, Pope? I'm going to excommunicate you. Excommunicate you. So the emperor, the governmental leader of all the people, is told by a guy in a funny hat, listen to me or you'll be excommunicated. My brain would tell me that the emperor would be like, shut your mouth, do what I want. What actually happened he was literally forced to come to Rome, approach the front door of the place where the Pope was, the Vatican, and get on his hands and knees and crawl into the throne room of the Pope and beg the Pope's permission to forgive him for even trying to threaten the Pope. And he did it. The Holy Roman Emperor crawled on his knees through the Vatican to apologize to the Pope and ask for forgiveness so he wouldn't go to hell when he died. That was it. Like, it's game over at that point. For the next couple centuries, it was absolute, complete governmental control. There'd still be some infighting and stuff, but I think Pope Innocent in the 1200s, Innocent III was not innocent of anything. He's a horrible human being. That was the height of his powers. Pope Innocent was basically like the godfather, just had ties to crime and all this stuff, controlled everything. It was just crazy. And then whenever a pope might die, I mean, imagine what being pope would have been like, right? This has nothing to do with Jesus. This is like absolute power. This is king. This is Caesar. This is emperor. So they would war over it. They'd fight over it. And this system would last for centuries. I mean, you know, you're talking when Columbus sails for America, there's a Holy Roman Emperor. It was also a time when churches in the East and the West drifted even more and more apart, to the point that they, by this point in time, the two churches are just completely at each other's throat. And eventually this thing happens called the Great Schism, which is what it sounds. They just completely break at this point. Under one of the emperors, they want to seek help from more Islamic invaders and back and forth. But eventually, the Eastern Patriarch, who's sort of the Pope's opposite but lesser over on the east side, is just getting upset with how arrogant the Pope has become, how he's just kind of made himself God. And so he says that all Eastern churches have to reject everything That is completely wrong. I'm sorry. That should say Greek, not Latin. They have to reject. If you're anywhere in the eastern side, you have to reject all things Holy Roman, or we're kicking out our country. Now, in retrospect, I have to admit, I think I would side with him. Like, I think if you knew what these Roman popes were doing, like, I'd be like, no, we're not having any of that. You're selling what to what? You're getting money for what? We don't want anything to do with you guys. Stay out of our country. Rome sends a delegation to try to make peace, but the delegation, of course, thinks he's high and mighty because he's a Roman. He insults them, and he actually issues a papal bull excommunicating the Constantinople patriarch. You're out of the kingdom. And the other guy's like, what the crap are you talking about? You don't have any power over me. I'm excommunicating you. So he excommunicates the other pope. And that is that. The great schism. The two would never again unite. You would officially have what would become the Eastern Orthodox Church. Why is it called the Orthodox Church? Because Orthodox means right thinking, or the right church. And then you'd have the Roman Catholic Church. No, we're the Catholic. We're the everything. You're not Catholic. We're Catholic. Just the arrogance of all those statements. You still have them today, right? You still have Catholics and these Orthodox. The two never came back together. Eventually, Constantinople would fall to the Turks. But the Eastern Church is still very much alive. The Eastern Church eventually would take deep, deep roots in Russia. And today, I mean, gosh, the Eastern Church is influencing what's happening in the Ukraine. Everything's connected. All that being said, anyway, that was the Great Schism. So by this point, you basically have two separate, you have the Holy Roman, the Roman Catholic and the Eastern Orthodox. If you're a Christian in the world in 1000 AD, you're either Roman Catholic or you're Eastern right-thinking Orthodox. And they just are at each other's throats. They're done with each other. No longer are they talking or doing anything together. I think John Paul would try to bridge the gap in the 60s a little bit, but I think they're nice to each other now, but it's been 1,000 years, we're still not really talking. I'm okay. I got like one page left. Two big events. First, I want to talk for 5 minutes about the differences. The reason I want to talk about the differences is not because it's a very important thing about church history, it's because it's just something I really enjoy and I'm passionate about, so deal with it. But the differences start here. For one, they spoke different languages. That's a big deal. It's not just a communication piece, like, oh, I can't understand you. They can understand each other. It's that how they actually interpreted the Bible mattered. The East read Koine Greek, what Paul was writing in. West refused to read in Greek because they didn't accept it. They believed the Bible should only be Latin. They had the Vulgate, which was the Latin translation that a guy named Jerome did in the 4th century, and that's what they read. So, which one is the most accurate translation of the Bible? I would say they were a lot closer. But that was a disagreement. They would fight over this because it's like, what are you saying? That's not what the Bible says. Those are right here. That's Latin. We're in Greek. And you don't know, like, really, that's a big deal. Theologically, and I kind of touched on this, and I'll come back to it a little bit. In the West, theology was very practical and very logical. It was like some of their big early people were lawyers, Tertullian, guys like Augustine, who were very like, its theology had a very like legal, God is a judge, you're guilty, you need to find forgiveness. Once you find forgiveness, you're okay, everything's good, yada, 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 kind of exchanging. Eastern was very philosophical. I mean, Greece is the home of philosophy. And the early church fathers in the East, guys like Gregory the Great and Basil and Athanasius and Irenaeus, were like very imaginative thinkers, very experiential. A much greater emphasis on the Holy Spirit happened in the East, and less of a focus on guilt before God and more of a focus on becoming like God. So a big idea in the Eastern Church, the Western Church is all about Jesus's blood forgives us from sin. The Eastern Church at the beginning was all about Jesus's victory helps us become more human. And those are kind of similar but different ways of looking at Christianity. I don't mind telling you that I do not consider myself a Western thinker. I'm very rooted in the early Eastern Desert Fathers. And I'm not alone because, starting about the 12th or 13th century, they started to come back together a little bit and you had a lot of Western scholastics like Thomas Aquinas and others got very interested in this kind of Eastern view and went back and started reading Irenaeus and these people, and it influenced a whole school of thought, especially in England. And the Church of England, Anglicanism, was actually very based on Eastern, more Eastern Christianity. A guy named John Wesley was an Anglican priest who converted and started what today is known as Methodism, Wesleyanism, the Nazarenes, and influenced a lot of other groups in American culture. So this has deep roots in American. Both of these exist. Most Americans are just kind of theological mutts. We just kind of believe a little bit about them. In the West, the Pope was the strongest. In the East, he wasn't. Like there was an emperor in the East for 1,000 years, and he didn't let the patriarch come and tell him what to do. So that was a big difference, right? Like if a Pope came to the East, like, I'm in charge, I'm like, no, you're not, the emperor's in charge, and vice versa. So differences. They didn't help each other, right? There was no, are we both Christians? Nah, right? And so that was a big deal. And then ultimately, the power of the Western church just really turned off the Eastern church. This idea that you're everything, you're mini Jesus over there? Like, no, we're not having that. Made it almost impossible for them to really get along. And all these factors played into this separation of East and West. And then for the next 1,000 years, they would remain pretty isolated and still are kind of today. I'll just say too, for the sake of clarifying, when I say I'm rooted, my theology is rooted in more Eastern Christianity, I am not an Eastern Orthodox. Just in the same way that the Catholic Church, and this will be next class, the Catholic Church found itself being filled with a lot of weird stuff. I gave you a list of them. There's a bunch of weird stuff that eventually soaked into what became known as Eastern Orthodox Church. I'm heavily influenced by the early church fathers, the guys in the first 2 or 3 centuries that lived in Greece and that area. I don't read anything from 900 AD from the Eastern Orthodox Church. I'm mostly just like, yeah, whatever. I look at the two Catholics and Eastern Orthodox, it's kind of similar in some ways, which is, I know I kind of just was like disparaging of them right there. I apologize for that. But I'm neither of those things. As you'll see next week, if you come to the next class, I consider myself a Protestant, first and foremost, which will mean something when we get to it. All right, I got 10 more minutes. Let me cover the last thing. The Western church would grow and expand, a lot of different things, a lot of different issues. Eventually, we will find that it will try to get healthy, but right around this time, before we see any attempts to get healthy, it probably hits a major low with one of its most famous decisions known as the Crusades. So you've probably heard of the Crusades. 300 years earlier, Islam quickly went through Arabia, modern day Israel, Palestine, took Jerusalem, controlled it all, and still did 300 years later. So around the turn of the millennium, Islam controls the Holy Land, which we'd call, you know, modern day Israel, Jerusalem. So in 1095, a pope named Urban II declared it the will of God, again, watch Kingdom of Heaven, it's all about this. God wills it to rescue the Holy Land and help the East from those Muslim invaders. Now, just for clarity, at no point has a pope in the West ever given a crap about the East or the Muslim invaders in the East. And really, think about this for a second. You got to look at time, right? 1095 was 400 years since Muhammad. 400 years. The Muslim invaders? I mean, that would literally be like someone in England, or I don't know, someone in France being like, we must go to America and fight off those English invaders. Like, what? What are you talking about? Yeah, back in, 17, whatever. You guys were fighting with England. We're here to help. Here to help? What are you talking about? 400 years. They decide to go to war with the invaders? They're not invaders anymore. Their great, 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 great grandkids are living there, settled and whatever. So why are they doing this? Well, the answer is actually pretty, pretty sucky. And the answer, the ultimate answer is the Pope's in charge with the Holy Roman Empire. They're trying to hold Europe together, but Europe is a feudal state with all these city-states that are still at each other's back. You've got all these different groups that are still fighting, bickering. They fought all the time. Like, they fought all the time. when the Muslim invaders came, they rallied them all, and here's a war, guys. But now there's no war. They're just fighting each other. The Holy Roman Emperor went to the Pope and said, what do we do about this? I can't stop all these people from fighting each other. And he said, basically, we need to give them something to do. So let's go kill some people. So that's what he did. He wanted to relieve tensions between feudal states that were warring. He wanted to give all these knights and their code of conduct, and I'm a warrior. Yeah, you need something to do. If I don't give you something to do, you're going to like hurt innocent people. So go over there and kill some brown people. That's pretty much it, right? I know that sounds terrible, but it's kind of, I mean, let's just acknowledge what we're talking about. I mean, like, these were others. They were different religion. They looked different than us. Let's just go kill them. Stop fighting with ourselves. So the Pope gets up and basically makes this impassioned speech. We need to go and defend the Holy Land, the birthplace of Jesus, from the Muslim hordes. Rise up, good Christian soldier, and let's go kill some people. And they do. They kill a lot of people. So they created rules for fighting based on Augustine's just war theory. Wait, is it right for us as Christians to go and kill those people? Well, it's a just war. What makes it just? I'm the Pope. Okay. Well, right? 700 years earlier, Augustine writes something in a book that defends the Crusades. Isn't that amazing? So they created rules and they just went and attacked. The First Crusade actually was successful. They took Jerusalem mainly because they showed up and the people were like, I'm sorry, what's happening? Like, they didn't have an army. They had no, like, what are we doing? They just wiped them out. They said they were going to help the East. They didn't help the East at all. They just went to the Holy Land and took it. And then the Muslims started actually coming together and trying to fight back. They eventually found a great leader named Saladin who put together a pretty good war and knocked them out. You had four Crusades, though. Each one kind of got worse and worse and worse. And what ended up happening was they would get kicked out, and then they'd go back, and then they'd get kicked out. They just kind of kept doing this thing. Eventually, by the Fourth Crusade, they had to go down through Greece and Constantinople to get there. The Fourth Crusade attacked Constantinople. They didn't even go to Jerusalem. They attacked Constantinople and sacked it and took all the riches away and took it back to Europe. This is what we've become, right? By 1200, that's where we were. In the end, after 200 years of back and forth fighting and thousands of people dying, the Crusades didn't, like they said, they painted crosses on their chests, but they just killed everybody. They killed Christians. There were a lot of Christians. There were Christian Arabs living in the Middle East. A lot of Christian Arabs. That's where Christianity started. There were tons of Christians there. These guys were like, if you look brown and you have a towel on your head, we're going to kill you. Right? It's a good thing we stopped all that nonsense, though. So by the end of it, they lose. Saladin kicks them out, and they go back to Europe with their tail between their legs. And all those people died for absolutely nothing. And that was the end of it. In 1947, the UN would make Israel a nation again and start all of this up again after a nice 600-year break. But that's all died down now. But really, when people say, like, we need peace in the Middle East, it's like, well, we've got about 900 years of tension there that we started. But by the turn of the millennium, the church is now a completely different organization. Small seeds of belief, small seeds of theology sprouted into something completely different. These moments of good men and women stepping in to fill a need, but gaining power led to their ancestors dominating and controlling everything. This movement that God started by coming to earth and calling us to follow him through self-denial, through service, through loving people, led to this. Crosses on my shield as I'm cutting your head off. Charles Martel running through Europe with his hammer. Become a Christian or die. Isn't that crazy? Christianity grew by suffering and facing death in the beginning, and then it became growing by causing death and suffering. Yeah. 1,000 years later, like, what is this? Do you even recognize it? It's merged completely with the government to form a new type of empire and power. Civil leaders beholden to the church. They hold the power of salvation, but they're corrupted and greedy and in bed with criminals. And wow, what a mess. So the papacy is now the most dominant position. Some of their theology is like, what are you talking about? Where'd that come from? Your question, where'd you get that, right? Yeah, it's all kind of a mess. And all this corruption and warfare, it begins to paint a picture that something is wrong. This church has lost its way. We're not what we're supposed to be. And again, painting in history in broad strokes, you know, it's not to say that at no point during any of this, no one was saying anything, right? There were people saying things. There were people, you can read writings of people that were like, I don't think this is a good idea. A lot of times they were called saints because they were murdered for saying it wasn't a good idea. Standing up against the government was not good for your health. But there were some people, like you can see it. But there were also people that confused me. I read something by a guy named Bernard of Clairvaux. Have you ever heard of Bernard of Clairvaux? Bernard of Clairvaux, I read this thing he wrote about experiencing the presence of God. He wrote it like 1,000 years ago. And it just was captivating and beautiful. And like, wow, like this guy knows Jesus. And then Bernard of Clairvaux wrote a treatise defending the Third Crusade and why it was good to go kill Muslims. I was like, how can you be the same person? And the reality is, it's easy, and I've said this before, I'll say it again, it's easy for me to stand here and just talk about the past and the stupid things people do. They're all humans, we're all humans, right? A class like this looks at like the big overarching movements. It doesn't talk about individual people. It doesn't talk about people who were angry and trying to speak up. It doesn't talk about the different sectarian groups that would just leave and say, we're not gonna be part of this and go start their own movements. That stuff was happening all the time. I think of it this way, and I'll end with this. I remember, Jamie, I think you're part of, Brandon told me a story. I don't know if you're with him. You guys were in Morocco, maybe, was it? And Brandon tells a story about how you guys were talking to the kids about what they think of American Christians. And I remember he's like, oh, Britney Spears. He was like, no. It's easy for me to be like, well, what was middle-aged Christian like? The Pope? And maybe an average monk who lived out in the wilderness and tithed and took care of the poor. I was like, no, don't paint me with that guy. I'm painting broad strokes. I have to, because it's an hour and a half church history class. Of course, they're still good people. Of course, Jesus is still moving people's lives. You can read guys like St. Francis and others who are doing amazing things during this period and clearly know the gospel and know the heart of Jesus. It's not like God just left. It's not like nobody on the planet still knew or had the Holy Spirit. And even some of the people that made bad decisions were probably in their heart trying to do what they thought was right, and they were just confused. I look at a guy like Bernard of Clairvaux, and I see a guy that was raised to believe that the Pope was infallible. And if the Pope's telling me to do this, man, I better do it because I want to obey God. He genuinely believed that. But it does lead to this issue when the church has absolute power, and they have their own police force, and they control the emperor and the army. What do you do? How do you stand up to it? How do you say anything? Would anyone challenge the power? And here's what's cool. The answer is yes, somebody would. Specifically, one man became probably the most famous person. About 450 years later, finally, after lots of trial and error, different people getting their heads cut off, one man stood up and said, I'm done with this. And he wrote down 99 things that the church was doing wrong, and he nailed them to a door and said, we need to fix this. And his name was Martin Luther, and he started the Reformation. So what we're gonna do is, if you want to, you're welcome to, if not, no big deal. You've got a good picture of the first 1,000 years of Christianity, but in 2 weeks, we're gonna come back together And we're going to talk about the people who started trying to reform the church and what it looked like. It was very hard, and they didn't reform the Catholic Church. They started a new one. Became known as Protestantism because they were protesting. We're going to talk about Martin Luther and John Calvin and Wycliffe and some of these other guys that were murdered for their faith. Some of the guys that actually made change and didn't die and were able to bring about real change. John Wesley and what would eventually lead to where we are today. So my next class in July will run from about 1200 to about 1600, right in there. And we'll look at the reforming of the church, trying to bring it and make it healthy again, and how that led to today.